They don't make them like they used to is a phrase that we hear a lot about a lot of things, right? Okay, there was a story happened a couple months ago. I was asked by one of you, okay, to change the direction that a refrigerator opened. Okay, you would think that this is a very straightforward circumstance. Just to move the refrigerator, opens on the right, you want it to open on the left. This seems like a really straightforward thing, okay? Here's the thing, it wasn't. It was not straightforward in any capacity. I sat there for what seemed like days. It was probably more like an hour and a half or something. And finally ended up changing the direction the refrigerator opened, and guess what? It still wasn't right. Okay, you open it, clunk, clunk, it was not right. Okay, it got solved, but that got me thinking, and I did some research on refrigerators and all sorts of stuff. Maybe you have a grandmother or something that has a refrigerator made in the 60s that's still working. Okay, and then you buy a brand new refrigerator now, and it lasts for a year. Okay, they don't make them like they used to, right? Just different thing. Think of the clothing that we wear, right? You go buy a T-shirt or something from Menards or Meijer or whatever, and then within a month it's stained or frayed, right? But it wasn't a joke either. People. Regardless, it's just different, right? Okay, but one thing that comes to mind that I think about a lot, okay, I was driving down the road through Appleton on Calumet and Oneida the other day and looked over and remembered that there used to be a Pizza Hut there. It's not there anymore. And I don't know if you remembered Pizza Hut in the 90s. It was the place to be, okay? All summer, you do your reading program, and then you get your you get your pizza at the end of the summer, right? And then the nice, awful stained glass light over the really lukewarm pizza, but then the arcade that your parents didn't care if you got hurt in. But now, they're gone. It's all gone. They don't make them like they used to, right? Think about your cell phone, right? If you breathe on your cell phone wrong, screen cracks, right? But the only thing I had to worry about my bright silver Motorola Razr, nothing. I didn't worry about it at all, right? It's probably still working because they don't make them like they used to. We often look back at the good old days and we glamorize it, right? Things before are better than what they are today. And as we come to the beginning of John 2 this morning, we see the gospel writer saying the same thing, right? He's saying they don't make them like they used to, but instead of saying it in some nostalgic, glamorized, negative way, he's looking at the person of Christ coming in the glory of the Father and is saying what is coming now is better than what came before. What is coming now is better than what came before. And we're reminded of Luke 16:16 that says the law and the prophets were until John, that is John the Baptist. And since then, the good news of the kingdom of God has been proclaimed. So John happened, the law and the prophets, and now what is coming now is better than what came before. But let's get situated a little bit, okay? Finishing John chapter 1 was a long process, okay? 8 sections in the first chapter of John's gospel where we see the greatness of Christ, the Logos of God, this divine self-expression. He's the creator, the sustainer, the glorious one of God. But in the middle of chapter 1, we see something that's a little bit depressing. It says, he came to his own, but they didn't receive him. We see the blindness that is Israel. The blindness of God's people, the Jewish people. We can see this even in chapter 1, verse 19, whenever the priests and the Levites come and question John the Baptist. Who are you? Because they were just blind. They were ignorant about what was going on. Peter, Nathanael, Philip, Andrew, and the other disciple that doesn't have a name, called out of Judaism. So chapter 1 leaves us with the Logos of God. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, but Israel is blind. And everything's coming out of this. In the words of Arthur Pink, he says, Judaism was but a dead husk. The heart and the life of it were gone. Only one thing remained, and that was to set it aside and bring in a new and better hope. And that's what we see. Chapter 1 ends with the blindness and the dead husk of Judaism. Chapter 2 begins with a statement about the passing away of Judaism and the replacement of the newness of Christ. And this is the first sign, John says, the first sign that Jesus produced. Notice it says sign. This is the first time we see this word, sign. Okay, we know signs happen. We know that. John writes, John 20, 30, and 31, there are many other things that Jesus did, but these are written, these what? These signs are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. Okay, and how many signs are there in John's gospel? Seven. There's seven signs in John's gospel, of which this is the first. Why seven? Seven's a very important number. Okay, if you don't know anything about Judaism, seven is a very important number. This is one of those texts, okay? And everybody's like, oh, what do I give a new believer? Give them the Gospel of John. Don't do that, okay? Because without an understanding of the Old Testament or Judaism, John only means a very little bit. There's seven signs because seven in the Jewish worldview is the number representing God's wholeness and perfection. There's seven signs in John's gospel between this one and chapter 12. It's called the Book of Signs. And that's where we are. But as we look at this text, you'll notice something very specific about it. It is a narrative, okay? We all like stories, right? We like good movies, okay? Sometimes we watch bad movies, but they're still movies, right? Some people like books. Some people are wrong. But stories are a way that we mark our lives. And we have narrative here. Now, we've got a little bit of narrative in chapter 1, but this is the first what we call a strict narrative, in that there is a beginning, a middle, and an end. Okay, everything else has just been, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this. But now we have, and then this, and then this, and then it ended. Okay, and as we look at Bible study, there's a tool. I don't care if you know this, but I'll tell you what it is. There's a tool called a Freytag pyramid. Okay, and this is how we analyze narratives. Okay, a Freytag pyramid is a triangle. Okay, that's what it is, hence it's called a pyramid. Okay, there's a setting and an inclement or a rising action. At some point, there is a climax. And then a very quick, it's called a denouement or a resolution or a result of the climax. Okay, that's how we analyze narratives. Okay, not just in the Bible, but in general. And as we look at this, we're actually going to look at it through those three lenses, the setting, the climax, and the result. Okay? That's how we're going to look at John chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. Now, how do we define climax? That's a very important thing, because if you've heard this story before, the climax is Jesus changed water into wine. Yay. And I'm going to argue that that's not the climax. That the climax is not Jesus changing water into wine. Okay? That's actually part of the setting and the rising action. So let's look at this. The setting. Okay, the setting of this. It says the third day. We're going to stop there. On the third day of what? The first week of the Gospel of John. That's where it is. If you notice through chapter 1, it's the only time in John's Gospel that days are numerated. Okay, if you look back, okay, in verse 19, this was John's testimony when the Jews come from Jerusalem, sent priests and Levites. Who are you? Okay, that's day one. And then it says, 29, the next day, this is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Verse 35, the next day. Okay, 43, the next day. That's four. And then on the third day, how many is that? Well, okay, it's not seven though. Right, that's our Western minds. We think four plus three is seven. But in a Jewish mind, they have something called inclusive counting. Okay? And we know this coming up this weekend. How many days was Jesus in the ground? For 3 days. Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Right? But it wasn't a 24-hour period. Because inclusive counting in the Jewish mind is if something happened on a day, that's day one. So on Friday, he died in the afternoon, but that's the first day he was in the grave. And then he was in the grave on Saturday, and then he was in the grave starting Sunday morning, but then he rose. That's day three. So he was in the grave for 3 days because of inclusive counting. So here we have the first day questioned by the priests and the Levites. The next day, blesses he who comes in the name of the Lord, right? The one who takes away the sin of the world. The next day, the other disciple and Andrew. The next day, Philip and Nathaniel. And then the third day. See how it changes the way that it's counting? So now we're starting on day four, and then we add two to it. So how many is that? Six. It's not 7 days, it's 6 days. Why is that important? Because the first chapter and a half of John outlines the week of creation. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. And all things that were created through him. What happened on the sixth day of creation? Mankind was created. Adam and Eve were created on day six, which is why in the Jewish mind, seven represents the wholeness and the perfection of God. Six represents humanity. That's the number representing humanity, is the number six. Which is interesting that we have in verse six here now six stone water jars. Why aren't there five? Why aren't there seven? Why aren't there 14? There were six. So still, we're ending chapter one with the blindness and the deadness of Israel, and we're already seeing on the third day, the six water jars, there's a humanity element that's going on here. There's a representation of humanity. We have 6 days, six jars, the sixth day of creation as we outline it. Even in Revelation 13, right, this beast that comes out whose name is 666, okay, this isn't some weird thing. It's not like there's going to be a barcode. Okay, the name is, it's almost God. It's a parody of divinity, but he's not quite there. He's just human. 666, right? Six represents humanity. So on the third day, there was a wedding at Cana. Let's stop there. A wedding. Why is it a wedding? Why is the first sign at a wedding? Because these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. And as we see in Matthew 22:2, it says the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding feast for his son. So the wedding is a picture of the relationship, this marital relationship between the Messiah and his people. So we're already setting the stage, right? The blindness of Israel, six representing humanity. It's on the sixth day representing the creation of man. The wedding representing the relationship between the Son of God and the people of God. And then we have Mary coming in, right? Not named, but we know the mother of Jesus, right? We've all been around church enough to know Jesus' mother's name is Mary, okay? Mary comes in. Jesus' mother was there and his disciples. How many disciples? We don't know. At least the five, right? Called in chapter one. Okay, so at least the five were there. Presumably this was a close friend or relative of Jesus' family, enough to where Jesus and his mother were invited to the wedding, enough to where Mary was concerned about the logistics going on at the wedding. So there's probably some close relationship there, but Mary's mother comes to him. They don't have any wine. Great. Okay? What does that have to do with me and you? Literally in Greek it says, that, what is it to me and you? What do we share about this? But then something happens that if it happened to me, it would not go well. He refers to his mother as woman. Okay? I grew up in a household where if my mother was referred to anything other than dearly beloved mother of whom I came forth from you, right? It would not go well at all, especially if I was like, hey, woman. Okay? Rule of thumb. Don't do that, okay? Scholars will want to tell you that whenever Jesus says gunai here, woman, he's referring to an endearing term, like, oh, dear woman, my fair lady, things like that's nowhere, there's no evidence for that, okay? Because they can't handle that Jesus is referring to his mother as woman, okay? But we see something here that is very important. Okay, remember we're on the sixth day of creation. What happened on the sixth day? Adam is created. Okay, Genesis 2:23. Eve is created. Man sees Eve, and what does he call her? woman. So now the new Adam is referring to the giver of life himself as woman. You see what we're doing? You see what John is doing? Is he's setting this up, saying newness, newness, betterness. Everything is better than what came before. My hour has not yet come. The hour, how many times is the hour of Christ referenced in the Gospel of John? 7 times. Okay, so we've got the 666, the 6, the 6, the 7, sign, 7, my hour. You see what he's saying? Every time the hour of Christ is talked about in the Gospel of John, it's referring not to the resurrection, not to the betrayal, to the death of Christ. Every time. So he's talking to the woman, the representation of the giver of life, about a situation at a wedding, the relationship between God and his people, on the 6th day as a representation of humanity, on the heels of the deadness of Israel. Do you see the setting is very important here? Last thing in the setting. Mary comes to him. They ran out of wine. Great, woman. My hour is not yet come. And then she looks at him. Have you ever thought about this? Why does she look at the servants and say, do whatever he says? Where do you get that, Mary? What does this have to do with me? My hour is not yet here. Do whatever he says. I'd look at this and be like, okay, I'm really sorry. I'll go find something else. Right? Maybe we can scrounge up some wine. Do whatever he says. John is referencing a very important story. Okay, remember in Egypt, all the way back in Genesis, there was a famine in the land. And there was a little Israelite boy in prison, could interpret dreams. He goes to the Pharaoh. It's going to be 7 years of famine, 7 years of plenty. The Pharaoh looks at the servants and says, do whatever he tells you, to Joseph. So by John writing this, Mary looked at the servants and says, do whatever he tells you. This is a statement from the gospel writer that says, he is no longer to be viewed as my son. He is the Lord. He has been lifted to a place of prominence. There's a famine of wine. It is running out. Do whatever he says because he will solve the problem. Right? He is now no longer a relation. He is the Lord. That is the setting that's happening here. Everything communicating the deadness of the Israelite people. Everything communicating that what is going on is representing humanity and the brokenness that is mankind. And then Christ comes in at the climax. Leon Morris, a Bible scholar, says, in this narrative, Jesus changes the waters of Judaism into the wine of Christianity. The following of Christ. And as we said, right, the climax here, the climax of a story, is when a conflict shifts. When the conflict rises to a certain place where now the setting shifts, the conflict comes to a turning point. Okay, so what is the actual climax? Often we hear the climax is turning the water into wine, but who knows that? Jesus? It says the servants and the disciples? Mary may not have even been there. Right? The setting doesn't technically change. It's still a wedding. The guests don't necessarily have any sense that there's running out of wine. The setting is still technically the same. So what is the climax? Verse 8, then he said to them, draw some out and take it to the head waiter. And they did. When the head waiter tasted the water after it had become wine, he did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. He called the groom and told him, everyone sets out the fine wine first, then after people are drunk, the inferior. But you have kept the fine wine until now. Why does John put that in there? Because he is proclaiming, making a very clear statement that what Christ does is better than what came before. The new wine is better than the old wine. That is the climax of the story. That is where the setting, the conflict actually shifts. Because it goes out to the people, and the one who represents the people, the head waiter, is aware now that something superior is here. Specifically Judaism, but this is where you and I come into the whole thing. We're not Jewish. Some of you might be Jewish, okay? Somewhere far, far in the way, right? Most of us are not Jewish here, but we share something in the Jewish worldview. We share something. We share a desire to make rules around worship. Okay? We desire that. We're real good at that. We're real good at doing that. I can make the boundary lines for worship. How many laws are there in the Old Testament? There's a lot, but does anybody know? 613 laws in the Old Testament. Okay? That's a lot of laws. Okay? I'm not saying that's not a lot of laws, but it is a lot. Okay? However, if you go to the Sanhedrin and you look at how many laws there are volumes and volumes and volumes and volumes and volumes of laws. Okay, this is the first thing that we see in Genesis, right? The command to Adam, okay? Don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Did God say don't touch it? No. Did God say you can't play hacky sack with it? No. Does God say you can't use it as a centerpiece on your divine table? No, he said don't eat it, right? But what happened whenever the serpent tempted Eve? She said, no, God said we can't eat that or touch it. There's a law that was made to keep them away from the law that was given. So mankind, six, creates the boundary lines, and we think we can do that. And then we think that if we follow the laws that we make, we get closer to God. That's the Jewish worldview. I can make whatever boundaries I want to make, and then if I follow those, I'll be holy like the Son of God. Yes, crushed it. Right? The second thing that Jews had, that Israel had, okay, that we also believe, if you're honest with yourself, is that they believe that they have a right to God. I believe they have a right to God. Okay, just because they're from the Jewish bloodline. Just because they live in a very small, isolated portion of the Middle East. Okay, they believe I'm God's person because of this. I have a right to God. Maybe you don't use those words. But maybe you look at bad things and you're like, no, I follow Jesus. It's not supposed to be this way. Right? Maybe you're looking at your relationship. Maybe you're looking at all the things and you're like, no, I'm reading my Bible. I'm praying. Why is this happening? God owes me something. It's not supposed to be like this. It's supposed to be better. I'm supposed to follow Jesus. I'm supposed to do these things. My Bible's here. I'm supposed to read it, and I'm reading it, but I don't feel close to God. My life isn't getting better. My job isn't getting better. All the things aren't working out. I'm praying, and it's not. God owes me something. I have a right to God. So no, you might not be Jewish, but you share a worldview. In the exact same way. And it all leads, all of it, leads to a place of feeling totally and completely inadequate. Totally and completely inadequate, just like the wedding where the wine is running out. Look at your life. Think about it so clear. Can you follow all the laws, even the laws that you make? You set these things up and you say, I'm going to determine the boundary lines of my worship. I'm going to determine the boundary lines and the laws. I'm going to put my relationship with Jesus into a nice little box, and then I'm going to live right inside the box, and the first thing you do is try to get out of the box. Right? The very first thing that we try to do is break the laws that we set. And you say, I have a right to God. It's not supposed to be this way, but it is this way. Right? Here's a story for you, okay? I was in the sauna. Always happens, okay? I promise I'm going to write a book or a blog or something called Sauna Talks. It's going to be tremendous, okay? All these things happen in the sauna. But I was talking to this guy, okay, a good friend of mine that I see regularly at the sauna, and we were having this conversation. And he looks at me and he goes, you're a Protestant, right? And I was like, sure am. And he goes, so you like to fight, right? And I was like, sure do. So we had this conversation and it was awesome. And he goes, you're so close-minded. Okay, this is how men talk to each other. Women, you might not understand this. He looks at me in the face and he's like, you're an idiot. Okay, and I was like, no, you are an idiot. So we just went back and forth, okay, and it was great. So he's one of these people who's just a free spirit, all religions go to the same place, like that kind of thing. And I looked at him and I said, tell me, friend, what makes you more open-minded than me? What makes you more open-minded than me? And he was like, I don't understand. I'm looking at all these religions and there's all truth in it. Some things aren't true, but some things are true. And you know, and I was like, okay, so that's my point. I'm looking at the Bible and saying, this is true. I have determined something that is true. You're looking at everything and you get to determine what is true. So why am I looking at an objective authority more closed-minded than you, who is the authority? Seems like we're both closed-minded. You just like to look at all the things and you say you're open about it. And I like to look at one thing and say, nope, this is true. See what I'm saying? These are both the same thing. I just have safety because it's outside of myself. He doesn't, because he is the one who gets to determine everything. He gets to look at all the different religions and say, I like this, I don't like this. I like this, I don't like this. And he's closed-minded because it's filtered through the brain that he has. Because he believes genuinely, like I do, like you do, that we have a right to God. That we can determine what is true, what is not true, the way things are supposed to be or not supposed to be. We can do all the things. This is what's happening in Judaism. But here we see Jesus changing the waters of Judaism, the dead husk without heart and without life, into Christianity that comes from the better place, the better wine that is Christ. But at the end of the day, the inadequacy is going to lead us into a place of sin, and we will enjoy sin. It says this, right? As the head waiter is talking to the groom, everyone sets out the fine wine first, but then after, people are drunk, the inferior, but you have kept the wine until now. And he's making a point. He's saying you will engage in the wine. You will engage in the activity, but the wine will run out. And at first, there will be pleasure in it. Let's not pretend, okay? We can be honest, right? Let's not pretend that sin is just feels bad, okay? It leads to a bad place, but when you're sinning, you're having a good time, okay? No one sins on accident, okay? Whenever we're sinning, like people, okay, we can be on real talk, okay? When we sin, we want to do it, okay? And it feels good to sin. The Proverbs tell us that all the time. Right? There's a way that seems right to a man. It's not like you're going to lie and you're like, this is wrong, but I'm going to do it anyways. You're like, I'm going to get out of it and it's going to be great. Right? When you're over drinking, it's not like, I'm going to, oh, bummer. No, you're over drinking because you're like, I like this. Right? But the pleasure of sin will give way to the consequence of sin. And the wages of sin is death. Every time. And here's what we see is the waters of the dead husk of your life is changed into the wine of Christianity. Which brings us to the result. 1 verse 11. Jesus did this and the first of his signs in Cana in Galilee, the first result, he revealed his glory. We already saw this in John 1:14. The word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. The glories of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. But now, whenever he's proclaiming, I am better than what came before, he revealed it. He made known. He pulled back the curtain. He pulled back the veil on the glory of God, and it was revealed. Okay, this is why we can't say that the climax of the story was that he turned water into wine. Because when we say that, what we're actually communicating is that the divinity, the beauty, the glory that is the Father represented the Son fixes problems. And that's the solution. Right? There was a problem being they ran out of wine. Jesus turned it into wine. He fixed the problem. And how many of us live that way when we're living a life of saying, there's problems, I have a right to God, it's not supposed to be this way, blah, 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 whatever. Jesus fixes the problem. And he's saying, no, that's not it. That's not the point. He revealed his glory by making better wine, not just more, better wine. and he revealed his glory. And this is what we ought to think about when we think of the Son of God: beautiful, valuable, desirable. Right? We should sing the words of Psalm 45, 10,000 men, and Christ is the most beautiful of all of them. It's a revelation of the perfection and beauty that is the Father coming to us, dwelling among us. That is the beauty of Christ, and it is most seen this coming weekend at the cross. The beauty of the glory of God, the hour of Christ, that in this story has not yet come. But it's leading to it, and leading to it, and leading to it. Seven times leading to the wholeness of God in the revelation of the glory of God that comes at the crucifixion of the Son. So the first result is that his glory was revealed. The second result, notice this, and his disciples believed in him. You say, wait a second, hold on. Didn't they already follow him? They were already there. Yeah, they were. But how many of us follow Jesus but still rely on ourselves? Right? How many of you say, I believe. Yeah, I said the prayer. I walked down the aisle. Great. And then something happens in your life and you're like, think of Job. Think of Job. Righteous and upright in his generation. He killed animals even for his potential sinning sons. Right? And then all the calamity befell Job. And we see towards the end of the book, he says, now I get it. I heard stories about you, but now, after all of this, I see you with my own eyes. Because there's a difference between looking at Jesus and saying, oh, I get it. You're a great teacher. You're a rabbi. I'll follow you. And now the revelation of the glory of God, and you believe in him. Not as someone primarily as useful, not as someone who is primarily there to solve all of your worldly woes, as someone who says, I'll make you have a better life, I'll give you peace, I'll get... No, you believe in him because he revealed the glory of the Father. You believe in him as the Messiah. You believe in him not because he does anything great for you, not because he gives you the warm fuzzies, but because you see beauty in every form that you can possibly imagine. Because what is coming now in the person of Jesus is better than anything you can think of. They believed in him, which is what we see on Palm Sunday. It's what we celebrate today as he comes into Jerusalem, proclaiming that he is the true and better king. For everyone to bow to submit their lives to. He is the chief cornerstone. It reminds me of a Puritan prayer, and I'll read it. It's called Christ is All. May I read the meltings of your heart to me, in the manger of your birth, in the garden of your agony, in the cross of your suffering, in the tomb of your resurrection, in the heaven of your intercession. Be bold in this thought. I defy my adversary. Tread down his temptations. Resist his schemings. Renounce the world. I am valiant for this truth. Deepen in me a sense of my holy relationship with you as spiritual bridegroom, as Jehovah's fellow, as sinner's friend. I think of your glory and my vileness, your majesty and my meanness, your beauty, my deformity, your purity, my filth, your righteousness, my iniquity. You have loved me everlastingly, unchangingly. May I love you as I am loved. You have given yourself for me. May I give myself to you. You have died for me. May I live for you in every moment of my time, in every movement of my mind, in every pulse of my heart. May I never dally with the world and its allurements, but walk by your side, listen to your voice, be clothed with your grace and adorned with your righteousness. That's the beauty of Christ. And friends, that's what we see here in the wedding at Cana. We see it in the setting as he is setting up the frailty and the depravity and the turning away of mankind, our hearts. We see it in the climax as he changes what was into something superior in every single way, and in the resolution, the result, as he reveals his glory and the disciples as we see him for who he truly is and we believe in him. And we're reminded of this perfect truth. As John writes it, the whole purpose of writing the gospel. These are written so that you and I may believe that Jesus, this Jesus, is the Messiah, the Son of God. And by believing, we may have life in his name. And that's what we have when we see the wedding at Cana, and that's what we have this Palm Sunday as we remember the coming of the Lord into a place that is better than what came before. Let's pray. Father, thank you. Thank you for the gift that is your Son. Thank you for the truth of your word that brings us into a very close and very superior relationship with your Son. We praise you for the wedding at Cana. We praise you for the kingdom of heaven being like a king who throws a wedding feast for his Son, and your Son is the chief of all. Your Son is more beautiful, more grand, more desirable, and more valuable than anything else, and we praise you for him. It's in his name alone we pray. Amen.